Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with your host Alejandro Rojas.
Hello and welcome. We have a special treat for myself, a special treat for you, and that is the Honorable Wendell Stevens is in the studio. So I have him right here with me. And remember, if you go to Ustream, just look up Open Minds Radio and you'll find us. But if you go to the Ustream, you'll see Wendell here with us. So this is going to be great. He retired as a colonel in the Air Force. He started in the 40s, his Air Force career. He was a pilot for many years. And so we'll be talking about that, including a lot of his UFO research that started even before World War II, and it started in the Air Force, so official UFO investigation. So we'll get into all of that. That's going to be a lot of fun. First, though, let me get into the news. So we can get into some of that fun with Wendell. Somebody said in the chat, and I told Wendell this, that you guys had names, because that little doll that we've had here, we'll ask Wendell a little bit more about it, but it's part of his collection, and the people in the chat have named him Chico Spock. So, and some gentleman said, you look better than Chico Spock, so who's usually being with us. So that was also, that was very nice of you, sir. All right, so let's get into some of the news. To start off with, Ted Ackworth. I like this story because I thought he was pretty cool. He was one of the guys on the UFO Hunters television show. In fact, he was the tall guy who was more of the scientific gentleman. And in the Boston Business Journal, they actually had an article on him and his extra entrepreneurial activities. And in fact, he's also a ghost hunter. So they've got a brand new show called Ghost Lab, and I believe it started last night. I DVR'd it. I haven't watched it yet, so I'll have to check that out. But, yeah, he's on a new show called Ghost Lab since he left the UFO Hunters, and they got a different scientific consultant for the show. Also, Russian news. This is kind of cool. Russia, and one of the websites is called TV100.ru. They're a news station out there in Russia. They posted a UFO video that they had received, and it is pretty strange. There's three lights. There's some blinking lights on it, but the configuration is pretty weird. So they thought it was pretty strange as well, and it made some big Russian news. Of course, when I posted that, I got a few people saying, wow, that is pretty weird. But most people were commenting on the pretty reporter, because they thought she was attractive. But the point was the UFO, not the pretty reporter. Another foreign, in fact, we have a lot of foreign news actually this week. One of them is this meteor crash in Latvia. You might have seen on YouTube or in some other places, All News Web was the first to post this. And this was what appeared to be people coming across the scene of a meteor crash with some fire in the middle of this big hole in the ground. Well, it came out that that was actually a hoax, and it was hoaxed by a television station. And their point was to show that Latvia can be the center of attention for the world. All it takes is one good story. So after a couple of days, it came out to be a hoax, and I don't know if that really justifies their hoax. We got all these hoaxes with them and Balloon Boy going on. It's unfortunate. Canada and Brazil also, and these are stories also on the All News Web. They cover a lot of great UFO news. But Canada and Brazil releasing UFO files in Canada. You can look at some records that show that Canada seemed to be concerned about UFOs landing in their territory. And then Brazil, a military leader, leaked out some a UFO event of what they believe to be a UFO crash. I think it was in the 70s. So this was in the past. In fact, according to our, I've been bringing him up a lot lately, Antonio, our specialist in South American ufology, actually all around the world. He's actually very read up on Russian ufology. He says that that's been out for a while. But interesting story there. If you remember, in Russia as well, there was in Moscow a very strange cloud formation. Well, there was another one in Romania. And if you're in the Ustream, you should be able to actually, well, they'll be bringing that up in a sec here. But in Romania, a very strange cloud formation similar to the one that they saw over Moscow. A circular thing that was kind of lit, really weird. There it is on the Ustream. Pretty weird picture. So nobody's sure what the first one was in Moscow, let alone this one here in Romania. Also, this is kind of a sad one. UFO writer Mac Tonies, he passed away, unfortunately, a young man. He's about the same age as me, 36, or he might have been 37. But he was a writer on lots of paranormal items, and he wrote for many, among many other things, he wrote for UFOmystic.com, which is a site ran by Greg Bishop, and Nick Redfern also writes for it, and people appreciate their out-of-the-box look at UFOs and looking into all of the possibilities behind the mysteries behind UFOs, and real unfortunate to see that he passed away, especially at such a young age. He was a great writer and a lot of fun, and so that's really too bad. You can, again, UFO Mystic has been writing updates on that and how you can console the family if you wish to do so. UK, of course, always has a lot of UFO news. They had sightings in Weston, Yarmouth, and Finland. And I know we have lots of UK listeners, so I apologize if I messed up the name of UFOs in your area, including video in Weston. And the video is, you know, the report is that this light, and this is a common report, someone sees a light in the sky, it zigs and zags in strange ways, and then it zings off, zigs and zags and zings. And that's what happened here. It's always hard to tell from a handheld camera if the light, you know, what's the person's hand jiggling and what's the actual light doing. But so it's hard to make much out in the video, but this was posted on their local paper, and they've got lots of UFOs news going on there. And then finally, a Brazilian UFO. This is another great one. This is a Brazilian news organization who wrote, whose news team actually was the group that captured this UFO on camera. So you can go to the site there and see that. All of these stories, right now you can see them housed at ufothinktank.com. We'll have them up on the open mic soon, but you can go see these stories and see these videos. It's a really interesting video. Again, it's lights in the night sky, but they're weird lights and caught the attention of the Brazilian news team there, and you can see their news story on that. So that's our UFO news for the week. Lots going on. There's always a lot going on, but let's talk to our guest, Wendell Stevens, and let's make sure everything is working. Hello, Wendell.
Yes, all right, sir.
Great. It's good to see you again.
Yep.
And we've been able to see you a lot, luckily, at Open Minds because you have brought your files here.
Yes.
But what I'd like to do for people is kind of start from the beginning, because you have an extraordinary history when it comes to UFO research that began in the Air Force. And when did your research in the Air Force begin?
Well, it began right after I rotated out of the Air Technical Intelligence Center at Wright Field. I came up for a normal rotational reassignment overseas, and when I got my orders, turned out to be Alaska, which was a territory at the time. And I was assigned to Anchorage Air Force Base, but I was assigned out of my specialty. My specialty was logistics and maintenance, and they assigned me in an operations specialty. And when I got there, I found I was going to be the assistant base operations officer with an additional duty of supervising a team from my old base at Wright Field of special, highly classified electricians or technicians that were installing special equipment aboard the B-29, flying their target profiles on Russia. And we put the equipment in every B-29 after it was winterized, and they took off on their target profile missions, sometimes more than one at night. But we launched them every night. And the incidence of encounters was only like two or three times a month. So there was they were not very often, but some of them were quite spectacular. In one case, the B-29 came on to a 200-foot diameter silvery disk sitting on the ice pack in the Arctic. And it leaped into the air and flew away, leaving no marks on the ground behind it. When we launched the B-29, it had a sea of equipment around it afterwards that covered a space much greater than the B-29, and there was all kinds of colored stains on the snow and ice from the different fluids the B-29 carries aboard. The gasoline was one color, oil was another, hydraulic fluid another, all different colors. And this thing launched itself with no support equipment and leaving no marks in the snow. And that was remarkable.
And the crew from the B-29 saw that crash.
They all the crew saw it. They called the others forward to take a look at it. And then it leaped into the air, flew away at high speed, disappeared ahead of the B-29. Another time they came on one floating on the open Arctic Ocean, and it submerged and disappeared as the B-29 approached, and they never saw it leave.
Wow.
A third time they came on one sitting on the water, open water, that jumped into the air and flew away ahead of the B-29. So these were really remarkable experiences. Mm-hmm. And we put the special equipment aboard the B-29s, included surge detectors in all the electrical systems. There are five on the B-29. We put radio frequency detectors to check for emissions, radio frequency emissions. We put magnetic detectors aboard. More cameras, photographic equipment, 35mm hand cameras and 16mm movie cameras. We even had a 35mm movie camera put aboard and an 8x10 Fairchild camera that took a picture on an 8x10 inch negative. All of those were for special opportunity capture of events if such a thing happens. We got, over the 2 years I did this, we got images and everything.
So you got pictures and movies of UFOs.
Yes, but we weren't allowed to process anything in the field.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't look at anything. We couldn't look at the tapes. Couldn't abstract anything. But we did. After an event, we would isolate the crews. Separate interrogators talked to each one. And their testimony was taken down in shorthand, typed up into an abstract, packaged with the cartridges, cassettes, and film rolls, and couriered to Washington in a metal box, chained off his wrist that night.
Wow. So, and what were these all discs?
There were some that were balls of light, coherent balls of light that they experienced, that took a position off a wingtip, for instance, on one B-29. It came in from the front at high speed, stopped on a wingtip, and took up the forward speed of the B-29 instantly. Stayed there for about a minute and a half. They kept recording disturbances in all the technical equipment aboard. Magnetic disturbances, thermal disturbances, the photographs that they captured, everything. And that was a good one.
Mm-hmm. And what was the feelings of the people, pilots and your superiors? How were they treating
the crew
level?
And my level, I believe that they were truly extraterrestrial,
mm-hmm.
because they were manifesting technologies that we certainly didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
We thought we had the best technologies in the world at the time. But my superiors didn't agree with me. They always thought they might be coming from someplace on the planet here and they were trying to find out where.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until just a few years ago, when I got to researching the Nazi disk, that I found that the Nazis had advanced to the point where they had a Hanabu 2, about 100 feet in diameter, that could land on water and submerge and fly underwater,
mm-hmm.
come out and fly away. So this might have been a further development of the Nazi technology. Now, we knew that before the war ended, the Nazis had 9 research bases working on the Nazi disk. And when they were reversed in Russia and being driven home, we knew that they had a strategy session to see what they could do to save Germany from being overrun. And they took the high-ranking Nazi and sent him to England to try to negotiate an armistice, mm-hmm. stop the fighting, save Germany. That failed. They took the second-ranking Nazi besides Hitler and sent it to South America to begin opening the grounds for the Fourth Reich to replace the Third Reich if it failed, if it was conquered.
Hmm.
And then they decided to decentralize German industry and open subsidiaries all over South America to provide an economic base for the future Fourth Reich to replace the Third if they lost the war. And the fourth was to decentralize all of their most secret and most advanced military research facilities and send them out of the country. And so they successfully dismantled and shipped out 7 of the Kugelblitz research bases. The 8th one was in progress of being moved when the Russians arrived and they plowed it under, blew it up and plowed it under.
So what year?
The 9th one was captured intact with all work in progress, finished, Hanabu was on the line, all the engineers and technicians, all the drawing blueprints, all the scientists, all the people involved were packaged and taken to Russia, to the northern Siberia, to the Taimyr Peninsula, where it was all put back to work again by the Russians.
Gotcha.
So, now, with hindsight, I could speculate that some of those events that we recorded in the Arctic were nothing more than Russian further development to the Nazi disk.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, I was certain that they were extraterrestrial.
Well, when was that time? When, what,
that was
when were those?
1947.
In 47 is when you were seeing these things around there,
yeah.
in Alaska. So, 47, and you think at that time, then Russia might have been experimenting.
At that time, they could have reactivated the Kugelblitz base that they captured intact.
Okay. And then prior to you working on this project in Alaska, you were working at Wright-Patterson?
Yes.
And what were you doing there?
I was a performance test pilot there.
Mm-hmm.
And we all had to have additional duties. The pilots didn't fly all the time. My additional duty was in the Air Technical Intelligence Center, the Foreign Technology Division.
Okay.
And I had a desk upstairs in the same building where Project Sign was organized on the ground floor as a public information office.
Mm-hmm.
It never was intended to be an investigative officer for a facility for the government.
Gotcha. And Sign was the precursor to Blue Book.
Sign was the first one. And then Drudge came along after that. You know, what happened to Sign is the staff only had a ceiling classification of confidential.
Mm-hmm.
So they could only handle reports that had already been purged upstairs and sent down to them. About half of the reports were blacked out. Then they began to get mail from the public addressed to Project Sign.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go to them, and some of these were case reports by witnesses, personal witnesses. And so Project Sign used to go out every once in a while when they had a good one. They'd take their own money and go out and look into it. And they found substantial support for some of these cases that led them to an impression that they weren't getting the right information down from upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
So they began to write their own analyses of the cases they were studying. This upset the people upstairs because now they're bucking the system. So they closed Project Book and reassigned all the people to bases where they wouldn't meet each other again.
I see.
Split them up.
So they broke it all up.
The records and closed Project Sign.
Mm-hmm.
But events still happened. They were still getting in the newspapers. The public was clamoring for an answer. And the Air Force was told to reopen Project Sign again. They didn't want it.
Hmm.
They tried to get the Navy to take it. They tried to get the Mesa, Pateka. They tried to give it to anybody they could, and finally the chief of staff says, no, it's an Air Force problem, you take it. So when they reopened the files, they aptly named it Project Grudge.
And they had a grudge against doing it, yeah.
And the same thing happened again.
Mm-hmm.
They closed it a second time.
And why did they close Grudge? What happened behind
that? Well, that Grudge was the one that Captain Ruffer ended up supervising. There was a change from first lieutenant to captain someplace midway in Project Grudge. And he began investigating cases on his own, and he wrote a book concluding that the phenomena was real, that the technology was not coming from this earth, that there was something to it, and that the Air Force should put more money into better research. And when the staff, upper staff, found out about this, it had already been published by a Book of the Month Club, and they managed to put enough pressure on the Book of the Month Club to have them recall all the books that they had mailed out.
Wow.
And they made rewrite the whole last chapter, changing the conclusion that they were truly extraterrestrials and should be given further study. And he wrote it up ending with the words, only time will tell.
Hmm.
That's the finished book. That's what was,
wow,
was reissued and went out the second time.
Do you have a copy of the
original?
I have
both. They're in the file back there.
Okay, great. Wow, incredible.
One has a different ending. The one that's in only time will tell is the rewrite.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up, the Ruppelt book.
Yeah, there's two of them side by side back there.
So then Blue Book starts up.
Okay, so same thing happened. They closed Project Sign or Project Grudge because Ruppelt had wrote the book, and now they wanted to get rid of the whole thing. And still, things are still happening. Reports are still being published in the newspapers. The public is still clamoring for answers. And so the commander, the new commander of the Air Technical Intelligence Center at Wright Field, picked an officer that was, he was a climber. He was the kind that would believe everything his superior told him, whether it was true or not.
Mm.
They told him that they were giving him all the information the Air Force had on UFOs, and he was supposed to handle the public. And his name was Quintanilla, Major Hector Quintanilla.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he really believed that he had all that the Air Force had, because he only had what was purged set down for that office. Mm-hmm. It was still only a public information office. In all this time, it never became a research office, ever. It never had the classification to do that.
I've seen a few quotes by him that he was, at least by the Socorro case, he was pretty baffled by that one.
Yeah.
And that was...
because he thought he had all the files, and now he's getting information that's not in his files.
Mm-hmm. So, and then, unfortunately, they closed the Blue Book.
So they closed Project Blue Book. The Air Force paid the first $300,000 contract with the University of Colorado to find the reason for closing Project Blue Book.
Mm-hmm.
And they appointed a pretty good staff of scientists to do the research. They took a lot of the cases that had been sent down to the project downstairs and went back and reinvestigated them and found out some of the information that had been purged out upstairs, found that some of those cases that could be explained away by the project downstairs, the PIO office, couldn't be explained away if you had the rest of the data.
Mm-hmm.
So they started writing their conclusions that the Air Force was fooling the public, that there was really more to it than in the Air Force was telling us. When that information got to, when the summary report got to Ulysses Condon, the head of the university, he said, we can't put this up. We've already taken $300,000 to kill the project. So he tore up their conclusions and wrote his own conclusion. It became the project, Blue Book, the Condon Report.
Yeah.
And two of the authors of the scientists quit when he did that. And one of them wrote a book, UFOs, Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I forget his name now, but the other one was that lives up there in Colorado, not too far above Aztec, where there was a crash one time.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me when we were researching the Aztec case that he was convinced that that was really real.
Wow.
That the sheriff was told that the convoy that was in the Hart Canyon was a prospect oil processing convoy, and they had oil drilling equipment and heavy vehicles and everything that they recovered the UFO and carried it out on a tank hauler and left the impression that even the sheriff firmly believed that that was an oil prospecting operation, so that they were really recovering that UFO to classification.
Yeah, we definitely will talk more about that. I've had some other Aztec researchers on before, so talked with Ryan Wood about that before. But one thing I wanted to ask, your investigations out in Alaska then, do you know if those made it to the Blue Book files?
They never did. None of them ever did. None of them.
So that showed that there were files beyond
Blue
Book.
We had a case in Tucson over my home area that we mentioned to Professor James McDonald at the Atmospheric Sciences Laboratory in the University of Arizona. He was teaching a mathematics class, and one of the students in the class was the former operations officer for the headquarters Western Air Defense Force Air Force at Hamilton Field, where they had the UFO files for everything west of the Mississippi. And one of the students said something about or mentioned something about a current report in the paper on UFOs, and the rest of the class giggled, and the professor kind of smirked and said, well, he said, if you want to talk to me about that, come up later. So Rudy Pestalozzi was in that class, and he went up and said, I noticed you didn't take much interest in the mention of the UFO event over Houston, over Tucson, that one of the students asked about. And he says, well, he says, that's all foolishness. He says, I don't like to get mixed up in that. And then he says, what do you think it is? He said, I think Blue Book, Project Blue Book is doing a good job. They report what there is, but he says it's not much. So Rudy said, would you like to come to a friend of mine's house some night, and we'll show you something that you can go check for yourself and verify that Project Blue Book is not handling the data? He said, yeah, I'd like to do that. So Rudy called me and he said, I'm going to come over and we're going to brief Professor McDonald. And he brought a case from the Tucson area that happened right there in town, all around us, and didn't get in the newspaper. So, and it wasn't in the Project Blue Book files either. So McDonald came to my house. We told him about a case where a B-36 based at Tucson at the time, refueled over the Catalina Mountains north of the city, flew a profile mission, then to the bomb range and made a simulated drop. And as it was getting off the tanker over the Catalinas, it was approached by a big disc that got in the slot behind the big wing, and the head of the small wing and the tail, and stayed there for about 8 or 9 minutes. And they got pictures with all the cameras aboard the craft. All the crew rotated to get a look at it. And when they reported this, they had a briefing team ready to separate the crew and interrogate them all separately. They reported to headquarters, 4th Air Force, and Rudy Pestalozzi, the same guy that was in the class, came over with his team from 4th Air Force headquarters.
Wow.
And they were interviewing the B-29 crew in the base courthouse, which was the base chapel was being used as a courthouse at the time to do this. And their whistle blew, siren blew at noon for the noon break for lunch, and they put their stuff away and went to the door of the courthouse. And as they stepped out on the porch, they saw everybody in the street looking up. And they looked up, and there was a silvery disc making sweeping passes up and down the street, and another one on high station observing all this. And then the first one went up on high station, the second one came down, swooped back and forth over the street.
Wow.
They stopped 40-some people and interviewed and took eyewitness statements from the street at the time, but they ran out with they got their own cameras, ran out on the street and took 8 press packs, 4x5 press packs, rolls of packages of film with their press cameras. They took 4 rolls of 35mm film with the 35mm cameras. One of them had an 8mm movie camera. They got 8mm movies of this event. And all this went to the photo lab. They closed the photo lab and stopped work to process all this film. Well, when people came back from lunch, they were all being called into their superior's office for briefing. And they were told that what they observed was a military operation. It was top secret that they could lose their jobs and maybe their lives if they said anything about this, because they couldn't talk to their families, they couldn't talk to anybody.
Wow.
So they successfully silenced it, never got into newspapers or anything like that. But now Rudy and his team prepared their standard report. The report was 3 inches thick, full of pictures and eyewitness testimony of the witnesses, the in the Virgin Yard, the pictures of them and everything. And they made this report in their standard 8 base, one to the next headquarters up, which was over in Texas, and another one to ADC, Air Defense Command, another one headquarters AMC, Air Materiel Command, another one to Chief of Staff of the Air Force. And now, he thought, Rudy Pestalozzi made these reports. He signed them and he left them. He made the distribution. So now we're going to take Professor McDonald out to the base to view the report.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get out to the base, to the operations section, and get to the classified section, we find that that folder has a telegram in it, just numbers that instructing the base to send that document forward to the next higher headquarters, which was Headquarters 12th Air Force over in Texas. We went over to Headquarters 12th Air Force and found, to see their copy, they had the same telegram ordering to send theirs and the lower files forward. So we went to ADC to see what happened to theirs. Theirs was gone, only a telegram in the file. So now we knew that all of the files were collected up someplace above and taken away from all the lower levels. So now McDonald had his story to go see if he could see if he could find if everything was going to Project Blue Book. Of course, he never found any of this in Project Blue Book.
Mm-hmm.
But he did find a general at staff level that had handled the report and sent it to a higher level yet. And so he went back, he went from there to Washington to see where it went. And at that time, that president was having a he would have two senators and two congressmen at the morning breakfast briefing every morning. And he opened the meeting with a little statement, and he called on his cabinet for comments on his statement, and then he invited the four guests to say anything if they wanted to. None of them wanted to say anything, but McDonald did want to say something. He stood up and raised his hand. The president said, yes. He said, I would like to know where the reports that are coming up from the lower levels are going. They're certainly not going into Project Blue Book. Where do they go? Everybody looked away from him, and his guest put on his sleeve to sit down and shut up. And he came back 2 weeks later to commit suicide. He was suicided by somebody else. He didn't commit suicide because now he had scored. Now he had something to work with.
That's scary. What year was that?
That was back, oh, I don't know when he died. It was in the middle 80s.
Okay, so that was, sometime after the Blue Book.
Yeah. Oh, well, after the Blue Book was closed.
Yeah. So in 47, going back to the timeline, that's, an incredible story, but it all points to, as many people can tell, not all the files were going to Blue Book.
No.
So
only what they wanted Blue Book to handle.
Mm-hmm. When did you get out of the Air Force? When did you retire?
I got out in 1964.
64.
Yeah.
So during the 50s and the 60s, were you working on more projects that had to do with UFOs? Or?
No, I went to a combat squadron. I was with a fighter interceptor squadron for a while, and then a total reconnaissance squadron.
Mm-hmm. And then you really got into your research after leaving the Air Force?
After I was doing it at the time, privately, on my own time.
Okay.
I had a MAG assignment in South America that let me do a lot of research down there,
mm-hmm.
and there were some real good cases that came to my attention at that time.
Oh, I think there it goes. All right, so then, and during that period of time, you've amassed this incredible photo library,
yeah.
Tons of photos.
Well, at the same time, I was collecting a lot of other stuff, too. I was also delivering airplanes to South America from the storage center after that.
Hmm.
And when I would take one to a foreign country, I would look for events that were going on, what was happening there, and go to personally investigate things that looked to be of interest in the field I was looking at. And that was contact with extraterrestrial beings that were different from us, that were coming from elsewhere, certainly not from this planet, because they were Earth kind of human, and they had different kinds of technologies, different kinds of ships and everything. So I spent a lot of time with those. And I used to come back and I'd write up a memorandum to myself on what the information that I wanted to keep in. And I wrote them like military reports, where they're like newsworthy news reports, where you get all the details in the first part of the report. There's no classic build, introductory build up to a climax or the close. It's the events as they happen, name, date, place, and time as they happen, exactly in the sequence that they took place. The surprises come right where the surprises were.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't come all at one point in the climate. And so I had these reports that I was making to myself. I had five filing cabinets full of them. And at one point, I looked at one that was about 4 inches thick, and I thought, oh, I ought to do something with that. I'll go through it and see what it looked like. And I finally ended up writing connecting paragraphs for the memorandums that I had written to myself. And it came out of this contact for Project Reticulum, Planet Reticulum.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first book I ever wrote. And it worked, looked pretty good. It worked pretty good. Then I did that 50 times or more over time.
Yeah, well, the 50s were full of the contactees and the contactee cases, which a lot of people forget about these days or just don't even know about.
Yeah.
Do you think that during that period of time something was going on different than now?
No, I don't see any great change in the nature of the phenomena. I see a change in reporting. It happens over time. Sometimes it's popular to report little green men.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's popular to report humanoids. Sometimes it's popular to report serpentoids. But the nature of the event doesn't seem to change much to me. It's just the fad of the reporting at a particular time. I think that humanity has been visited ever since they had been here. Not a recent event or a new event.
Mm-hmm.
When life was planted here, other planets in advanced status knew about it, came and looked at nascent life developing here, and observed it all the way down the line.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the first contactee cases you looked into?
Well, the first one that caught my attention was the Identity case.
Mm-hmm.
And that was because he took those pictures of sharp, good-looking images with a homemade telescope and a through-the-lens viewing camera mapped tape to the eyepiece. And he got pretty good pictures. That was the first real good pictures of UFOs. Well, when I checked into the case, I found that he had been hearing voices for some time before that. He had also seen the craft before that. Just happened to be the time that he got the first photographic images. And, of course, he was attacked by everybody. When the report came out in the Los Angeles Times, everybody attacked him as a fraud and a faker and everything you could imagine. But when I visited the area, he's already passed on by the time I got there the first time.
Mm.
But his friend that was helping him a lot.
Desmond Leslie?
No, not Desmond Leslie. He was the other guy. His son now is running the center.
Okay. I can't remember the name either, but I know what you're talking about.
He was a German fighter pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And he was interested in what Adamski was doing. Adamski was a soldier, an officer, in World War One, and he was not a flake. He was made to look like a flake by the government and everybody else, but he was a pretty sharp man. He was also pretty well self-educated in metaphysics. And he used to hold a metaphysics study class in his home out in Palomar, California, for young people who wanted to discuss such things on Friday nights a couple times a month. And he was kind of regarded as a mystic around the area, which didn't help his reputation a lot. But he did get the good pictures. And, you know, after those pictures appeared in the New Los Angeles Times, Jim and Carl Lorenzo from APRO here in Tucson. And APRO was the first civilian organization in the world. It's founded by civilians to study the phenomena. It was kind of modeled after NICAP, which was supposed to be the first civilian organization in the world, but never was, because NICAP was founded by six retired CIA officers that organized the company and then brought in a non-CIA man to head it as the president of the country, Major Keogh. He had a good reputation as a patriotic major, but he didn't know background of his, or not enough of the background of his sponsors. But he ran NICAP for a number of years, and NICAP was nothing but a CIA property collecting information that pretending to be a civilian organization to get people that wouldn't talk to the government to talk to NICAP.
He did go a long way in supporting the idea that the UFOs are not from this planet.
Yeah, Keogh did. He tried to go a long way there, and I think that some of the NICAP officers even had the same belief.
I know the first director of the CIA, Roscoe Hillenkoetter, was with NICAP. Do you think he believed that as well?
Well, he had the truth. He knew exactly what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
He knew about the attempts to close it up and keep the public from knowing anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And by the way, one of our space carriers is named Hillenkoetter.
It's
USSS Hillenkoetter, United States Spaceship Hillenkoetter.
I heard that from, I think I've mentioned that on the show, too, that some
and
people...
And the other one, another one is named Borisov, not Borisov.
LeMay.
LeMay, yeah.
Yeah, from, and supposedly that's information Gary McKinnon found.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I hadn't been able to find a source directly from him on that, but I've heard that anecdotally. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting.
I tend to go ahead the information.
Now, getting back to Adamski, someone asked, oh, man, it'd be great to see some of those pictures. And we do have, well, when we get all of our website up, we've got some great pictures, and we'll get more of your pictures up there as well. But you can actually find Adamski pictures all over the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And he had lots of photos. He also had some film. And I think it was, I know the guy who runs the Adamski Foundation, yeah, his wife had a sighting with Adamski and mm-hmm. spoke on it. And there were some people from Kodak Labs who researched and supported his film.
Yeah, MGM Studios did also, with their best technical effects experts. They couldn't explain how he took those pictures.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't with models. They were taken at a distance. And, you know, AFRO had just been formed, and Jim and Carl Lorenzen went over there to interview Adamski. And Coral was a very pretty woman at the time. She was a young woman, very pretty. But she had a caustic tongue, and they got there, and they found Adamski. He wasn't at home, but they found him in the hamburger shop with his sister-in-law or something like that. And he invited him to sit down. He's eating a hot dog. And they sat down across him, and Coral Lorenzen pursed her fingers like that and looked over and said, "Tell me, George, just how the hell did you do it?" Right away, he knew they weren't there to find any facts, that they were there to feed it into the wall. So he took his hot dog and moved to another table. He said, "Well, you can just take a hubcap, show it in here, and take a picture. If you want to go ahead and make your own." He moved away, and he wouldn't talk to him after that. So the Lorenzen came back and wrote up their report of investigation of Adamski's pictures made with a hubcap.
Mm.
And everybody else copied the AFRO report. Nobody else ever went out there and investigated them until the guy, the airline pilot from New Zealand, Bruce Caffey, came to the United States, met Adamski in his home, convinced Adamski that he really wanted to see what Adamski experienced, and they went up to the site and walked over it. Adamski explained everything that happened. Bruce Caffey went to George Hunt Williamson and his wife, who were with Adamski at the time, and to Al Bailey, the telegraph operator at a little town outside of Prescott, who was also there with his wife. Now, he was getting contact from the same people that was railroad telegraph that the deputy was meeting in the desert.
Hmm.
And George Hunt Willis was getting contact by metal transmission. And they were all told to go to that diner on the highway near Blight.
Really?
Where they met together and made a convoy up into the desert north of Blight. Women had from Prescott had prepared the picnic lunch. And when they got there and found a quiet place to stop alongside the road, Adamski asked Williamson to drive him up off the road, away up a trail there in Adamski's car. So he got out with his telescope and he set it up and told Williamson to go back with the party on the road. He'd wave to him when he's ready to get picked up. But Williamson left, and before he got back to the party, the man came out from around the rock and talked to Adamski, and then only a couple of minutes, and then he left. So Adamski went and waited for Williams to come back almost after he parked the car. He came back and picked Adamski up. There was a track in the desert dust there. And Williams said, "You ought to be able to, I wish there was a way to make a cast." And Adamski said, "I've got plaster and water in my car. I was told to bring it." So they got it out and made the plaster cast. It became famous after that.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason they had the plaster and water is because the people that told Adamski to go there and meet him told him to go to the drugstore and get a package of plaster of Paris and take a jug of water.
It's it. Well, and then well, to support this case, more was who I mentioned before, Sir Desmond Leslie, who was an Air Force ace for the Britain.
Yep.
And he did a lot of research and was able to confirm. Now, did he confirm that Adamski was delivering packages to the royal family? Think something similar.
He was invited to an audience, private audience, with the King and Queen of the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. I know that. I don't know about the royal family in England.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also was given a message to take to Pope John the 23rd.
Yeah.
But, you know, if Adamski was such a fraud, as the government tried to allege, why, when you have a substantial contact with his visitors, why did they send a VIP airplane from Washington to Miramar Naval Air Station to pick him up, fly him back to Washington for debriefing, and then fly him back to Miramar Naval Air Station?
Mm-hmm.
If he's such a nut, why are they doing that? They did that a half a dozen times when he had substantial contact.
Yeah, so Adamski is a case that people like to blow off now, but when you look into the details, even
it's really real.
Yeah, there's a lot substantiating it, and even though the photos are too good to be true, I mean, and the film, they're extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Something seems to be going on there.
Well, there was a lot of other cases fed back into the Adamski case. Bill Clendenin up in Washington was he had taken some trash out to his incinerator behind his house. And he saw, as he was out this twilight, which is the end of the day, he saw a light to the north going from east to west. And he stopped and looked at it, and then he saw it stop and make a sharp right-angle turn and head towards the space needle down in the bay there. And it got to the space needle and made another sharp angle turn right towards his house and came right at him descending. All the way, when it got to his house, it was low enough, he said, he could have thrown a rolled newspaper and hit it. It passed over his head slowly and then flew off at low level over the Naval Air Station to the east of him there. And Bill Clinton then was contacted a number of times. He was taken aboard after that. And one time when he was taken aboard, he asked to see the power unit in the bottom, where the hemispheres were. And they took him to the level underneath. They showed him the hemispheres. You could look at them from the top down.
Yeah.
He said it looked like what was in the hemispheres was something like a carbon Christmas tree inverted upside down into the sphere, hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
And there was heavy wires running from the base of the Christmas tree across to the center of the ship and then to a box on the wall. And so don't touch the wires, it'd be deadly.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of power in them. And so he did not, but he observed what was in those hemispheres from inside the ship. He didn't know what kind of gas it was in or what else was in there, but he could see the carbon, the inverted carbon Christmas tree, what it looked like down in the hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill Clendenin tried to figure out how that could work all the rest of his life. He tried to make a model of it. He took courses in physics to try to do this. And he told me that he thinks that there was mercury vapor in the spheres, and that the mercury vapor was rotated in the spheres, and that somehow it interacted with the carbon charged rods that produced the energy or generated energy of some kind that made the whole thing work.
Which is interesting, and I'll get to that in just a second. But when you're talking about the hemispheres, on a lot of the Adamski photos, but a lot of photos actually from that time period, including some
hemisphere.
Other contactees.
Yeah.
And I got it, if you're on Ustream, you can see, you know, this is one of Wendell's from his, and you can see on the bottom these little balls. But if you go look at the Adamski pictures, you see those little balls at the bottom. And
they're much
the
bigger
hemispheres.
In the Adamski pictures, yeah.
Yeah, much bigger than in this model here. But that's what you're referring to. And there were many other contactees that took similar pictures of these.
A lot of them had those hemispheres on.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the other contactees, or some of them weren't even contactees, some were just people who took photos of similar craft?
Well, Kelvin Rowe was visited by beings that arrived in the ship very much like that. The ship that Bill Clendenin saw was exactly like the photographs that Adamski had.
Hmm. Weren't there some kids in Britain that took a picture?
They're young boys,
yeah.
8 and 10 years old, yes.
Mm-hmm.
With a cheap pinhole camera. And they got images that a scientist down in Brazil did orthographic projection of those pictures, and they got exactly the outline that matched the Adamski outline profile.
Mm-hmm. And then there was another famous contactee of the time, and I can't remember. He took a photo of a similar craft with a person, what he said was one of the planets in front of it.
Cedric Allingham.
Right. Cedric Allingham took that mm-hmm. picture. So what do you think was going on there? It seemed like those craft were only during that one period of time.
You know, that's a mystery to me. Those ships looked very much like the Nazi ships that were in development in the 1940s,
mm-hmm.
38 to 44. And they have the same hemispheres underneath. They look so much like the Nazi developments. It makes one wonder if the ones we saw in 1945 weren't some of the Nazi developments that were evacuated and disappeared from sight altogether, being experienced by other people. If you remember, there were some reports of those Venusians speaking English with a German accent. And we always wondered about that.
Well, do you think there's a possibility that they were flying these, somebody, Russians or Germans, were flying these things, tricking people, that those people weren't contacted?
I don't think they were tricking people so much as people were drawing their own false conclusions.
Okay. Oh, people who were seeing these things?
I don't
think
it was a deliberate trick, yeah.
Okay.
There was a case back in Kansas where one landed alongside the road and one asked the motorist to stop for water, for direction for water. And that motorist told him there's a reservoir over the hill ways. And they took off and went to the reservoir to get water. I don't know. They said that they told their witnesses that they came here from Venus. And if you remember, the mindset at the time was such that we thought we were the apex of creation for all the universe, and if there was any other life out there, it would have to be from the adjacent planets, Mars or Venus. We couldn't even entertain the idea of life coming from Andromeda, for instance, or the Pleiades, or anything beyond Mars and Venus. And so I think that if they were truly extraterrestrial, they gave us that information because that was all that would be acceptable to Earth humanity
mm-hmm.
at the time.
Well, and some of these guys, Adamski, he had, I guess, did he have telepathic contacts?
Yes.
So if these things coming out of the craft were telepathically...
No, they took him aboard the craft. He went on trips with them. They took him to the moon, for instance. Showed him the backside of the moon.
And, I'm looking right here at some of the other contactees. George Van Tassel was a famous one. He started the Giant Rock.
Oh, Angelucci was one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you go to the Giant Rock conferences?
Not in the 40s,
mm-hmm.
but I did in the revivals in the 50s and 60s.
Now, Giant Rock, maybe for the people who don't know about it, do you want to kind of explain what that was?
It was the largest single boulder that was known in the world, and it sat in the desert northeast of Los Angeles up near 29 Palms, above 29 Palms. And there was a cavern underneath, and George Van Tassel set up his shop in the cave underneath the rock. And they had the formal gatherings there of UFO believers would come there, listen to Van Tassel, who was also a contactee, expound on his relationship with the extraterrestrial beings. He also told him they came from Venus. And he wrote a whole book, Proceedings, of the various contacts that he had with them. And what I found interesting about the Proceedings is it had a lot of cosmology that looked like it fitted the same ideas that was in the Ohasty book that was published by metaphysical researchers. Philosophy was a book that was written at night by a New England farmer that he was a heavy smoker of black cigars, strong black cigars, drank a lot of whiskey. And he woke up one night after early in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, with a radiant being standing at the foot of his bed, looking at him. And he said that you're spending too much of your life on your excesses. You should cut down on the drinking and cut down on the smoking. And we have a mission for you. And he threw a shoe at it or something, and it left. But then a few days later, he began to notice that he wasn't drinking as much.
Hmm.
And he wasn't smoking as much. They came back 2 months later and said, we see you're making progress. You've almost given up the drinking and the smoking. Now we are going to give you a writing machine. And they told him to, when he got the machine, to set it up in his basement and get a roll of newsprint to copy on. So he's wondering about this when the inventor of the Scholes typewriter had three models that had a big keyboard the size of an organ, a piano keyboard, and big keys that typed on rolls of newsprint. And they were the first typewriters in the world. And the owner of one of them died and left it to the smoker and the drinker. And it was delivered to his house.
What?
He set it up in the basement. He was awakened again every morning at 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, taken to the basement in the dark. The house was filled with blue light when this happened. He'd go down and he sat down in his typewriter, which was a big thing, with the roll of newsprint in the back, which is a big roll of paper. And he'd type automatically by hand, some form of automatic typing on the keyboard. And he was told not to read what was coming out of the typewriter on the newsprint sheet. So he'd tear them off every so far and turn them upside down. And he did this for months. He only had 500 pages piled by side to side, all upside down. They told him don't bother reading it. We'll have to send it to a printer. So they finally, when they finished, they gave him an address to send the package to. And he wrote them a letter to see what they were going to do with it. And they said that they were expecting the delivery, that they were going to set it up in a print, in the book, form of a book.
Wow.
And,
did they say why they were expecting or how they were expecting it?
They didn't say. I don't know how they were expecting it. But they got the package of paper and they printed it up in this book that's called OHASPE, O-H-A-S-P-E. Supposedly the sounds of the four winds. And it's a remarkable book. It's got a lot of information about it. And it's published in such a way that the upper half of the page shows what's transpiring in the astral above the physical level. At spirit level, and the lower half of the page, it has a wavy line separating the upper from the lower, tells what's happening in the physical world at the same time as what's going on in the spiritual world.
Wow.
So you get to see how the interaction between the spirit world and the physical world is taking place.
That's pretty amazing. Do you know if that book is still available?
You can find it in used bookstores. It's a remarkable book.
And so the messages Van Tassel was receiving were similar.
Very similar to the cosmology that Van Tassel was being given was very similar to the cosmology aspects of the OHASPE book.
And then, for the listeners also, George Van Tassel and his giant rock meetings, those had thousands of people.
Yes, they would get as many as 5,000, 10,000 people.
Wow, yeah, the pictures
in
are
in the
amazing.
Desert with no buildings.
Yeah, just right out
just
there.
Right
in
out in the open desert.
He had a little airport.
He'd get on top of
the
giant rock and preach.
Yeah, incredible. It's incredible to see these pictures of these thousands of people hanging out. And they look to be, you know, they're in their suit jackets like they used to wear back then, and in their ties and well-groomed people, not a bunch of bohemians out in the desert.
Yeah. You know, there was a picture taken. There was a police officer that was often hired to work the giant rock meetings. Yeah, in an off-duty capacity. And he had come in his uniform, and he didn't believe in UFOs. He didn't believe in anything that was going on there, but he was getting paid to keep bothering the crowd. But he used to chide the important people that came about their screwy belief. And he'd chide people about being there to get this strange information. And one day, he was talking to Bob Short and his wife, and Oswaldo Rodriguez, I think his name was him and his twin brother began having contact with alien extraterrestrials when they were 8 years old. And then now he's 19 or 20 years old. Contact had been going on for over 10 years. And he and his brother were told to go to this rendezvous point in the desert. They had a hard time finding it, but they were guided, kind of steered, until they got to this remote place in the dark, and before midnight, and they parked their car and tipped back their feet to go try to get some rest. And before daylight, they heard cars pulling in all around them, headlights flashing, people talking outside, and they got woke up, and they got out of their car to see what was going on, and the people were gathering for the first Giant Rock convention. I know it's the second one. And they waited, they watched the crowd gather, and by 9 o'clock in the morning, this policeman is still ridiculing attendees for being there. And why would they come so far to a place with no buildings or anything like that to meet extraterrestrials? And he's talking about shortening his life when an object appeared over the crowd, a big, luminous, radiant object, semi-lens shape. And the policeman had his police camera, an old Polaroid camera that had the metal one, the picture had the cure, 60 seconds in the camera before you could take it out and take another picture. And somebody said, get a picture of that. And so the policeman took the camera out, opened it up. He took one shot, and he had to wait for it to cure before he could take it out, during which time Bob Short's wife got her camera out and took another picture of the same thing in the sky. And this young man, Oswaldo Rodriguez, came up to the policeman and said, hey, can I get a copy of that picture? And the policeman said, give me your address. I'll send you one. So he did, and that cop every day was sending me one, because now I meet this guy 50 years later. He's now in his high 70s. And he told me that he still had that copy of the picture. And when I matched it up with the old report, it's the one that's in the book put out by, who was it? Somebody published the book with that picture. But Bob Short's wife had another picture just like it, taken from a few feet away. I didn't know that. And I had never seen it before. And about 2 years ago, we had a reunion at Giant Rock, and I called this Oswaldo and asked him if he'd join me there. So we went there. Bob Short and his wife were there.
Great.
And I introduced Oswaldo to Bob Short and his wife, and Oswaldo had his copy of the picture that the police had sent him, and they matched the one that Bob Short's wife had taken. So that was an interesting confirmation to me.
Is that picture in your files as well?
Yeah, someplace in there, and it probably in date and time place location.
I guess before I forget, it kind of brings us back to the Mercury thing. But you know, they also I've heard, and you might have heard this, that some of the shapes, and I grabbed another one of Wendell's models, that just a circular, typical flying saucer. That some people have been told that there's a ring of Mercury on the outer edge of the craft that spins to help them do whatever they do.
I heard that too.
Yeah, you have. So Mercury seems to be a component.
Somehow. It's involved in a number of cases where they describe spinning Mercury.
Yeah.
I think even in the German disk research, Schauberger was told to spin Mercury at high speed, a high-speed Mercury vortex to get his anti-gravity effect in the distance he was working in.
It's interesting because one of the reasons it's interesting to us is we had a gentleman come in who is able to find materials. He kind of works with mining and stuff like that to find minerals under the ground. And he was told by some locals about this mountain where they saw UFOs going in and out of, and he went out there and he found a circular somehow underground. He didn't see it.
Really?
But with his instruments, he detected this Mercury in a circular pattern underground. And when he went back to check it later, it wasn't there.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. So I told him about how people had said, possibly around the disk, and he was pretty floored by that.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
So that kind of brings us, I guess, to, Herman, who helped you write your first book. He had his own experiences.
Yeah, he was a born-again Christian. He was a deacon in his church. He passed a collection plate. He taught Sunday school, and he helped keep the books for the church when his contact began. And before his contact, he would have laughed at anybody trying to tell him a story about UFOs, because his church believed that since they didn't have, apparently didn't have a Christ, they had to be coming from the Antichrist side, and they didn't want to get involved. And so they always tried to discourage everything they could in that respect. And then his contact, the first just voices in his head grew stronger, and he saw the object flying down the power lines, and he knew that the power lines made an angular turn in the Ashley River and went up across the fairgrounds. So he cut across to the fairgrounds to see if it was going to keep following the lines. Sure did, nothing. He made the turn and came up the power lines. He took four good pictures of that. Those were the first pictures he got. And
what did the craft look like?
The first one looked more like a straw hat, an old-fashioned straw hat than anything else. It had a squared top and a flat brim. And it was dark colored, the dark gray color in gray clouds. The pictures weren't very sharp or very good because the lighting was not good that day, and he had a cheap camera. But they were the first four pictures he got. And then that was the report that got in the newspapers that the next day this fake Tom Olson appeared on the scene and wanted to go to the fairgrounds or go see where the pictures were taken. Bill Herman had not given him any direction to his house, but he drove up in a car. And when Bill got in the car with him, he drove right to the fairgrounds without asking directions about where the pictures were taken. So somebody is listening to snooping at Herman's lines or whatever was going on. They had already picked it up. And it was when they were returning from the fairgrounds, he asked Herman if he really thought this story was real. And Herman said, of course, I experienced it. He said, would you be willing to take a polygraph test on it? Herman said, certainly. He drove him to a hotel where there were two men waiting. A doctor and a polygraph expert in a hotel room. And he took him in there. And Herman now is being a little cowed by three men that he has never met before. And they all know more about his contact than he had told most people. And he asked him to sit down. He didn't want to sit down. He was trying to figure out how he was going to get out of there. And the doctor pulled a doctor's bag out under the bed, took out a syringe, took some stuff out of a bottle, and said, you look a little agitated. Let me give you something to calm you down.
Wow.
He gave him a shot in the arm.
Mm-hmm.
The polygraph expert pulled his bag out from under the bed, rigged up the polygraph machine, put the wires and stuff on Bill, and then instead of asking him the questions that the polygraph expert asked, he asked him to describe the nature of his first visit aboard the spacecraft in the involuntary abduction.
That's not a yes or no question
at all. So what they were doing is using the polygraph machine to look for aberration. If he didn't fully understand something, they'd re-question him until he got it cleared up. They were using the polygraph machine to tell whether his subconscious was understood the question or understood the details or not.
Interesting. And so did they do, I think someone had mentioned possibly the medical physical that they did on him?
Well, they only checked his blood pressure and his temperature.
Okay.
They didn't give him any kind of an examination. They didn't really give him a polygraph test. But it lasted about 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the polygraph test didn't last over 20 minutes.
Wow.
And after it was over and the polygraph expert started putting his stuff away and the doctor started putting his doctor's tools back in the bag, his fake Tom Olson said, you look a little tired. Can I take you to that seafood restaurant on the pier where they have the big sea crabs? And Bill says, no, I just want to go home. I'm tired. I want to get out of here. I've got a terrible headache. So they took him home and dropped him off. And he realized that he didn't get a polygraph test at all when they got all this information. But it was just used to interrogate his subconscious to develop more detail.
And all of this, or a lot of the stories in your first book, Contact from Zeta Reticuli.
Mm-hmm.
So how many books have you written now?
Well, I've got 32 hardcover books that I published.
Mm-hmm.
And then time came when I couldn't afford to publish anymore. I had my house mortgage to the limit and everything. And so I started, by then the computer age had come along and I had gotten a new computer and Susie says, why don't you write it up as an e-book? I said, what's that? She said, well, you just make a book like you do.
Right.
Elsewhere, you make the pages, you copy ready to take to a printer, make them copy ready and file them, store them in the computer. And when you got the book done, you just pull them out in chapters and transfer it to a disc. You got an electronic book. So we started doing that. We did another 30 books.
Yeah, I know with the IARGAN, your IARGAN book is online.
Yeah.
My cousin
it was also
was
a hardback.
Download
book.
That and read that. Yeah, yeah, I've seen the hardback. And in fact, bringing that up, you know, the guy is online who named the little guy, the little IARGAN doll.
Oh, yeah.
Chico Spock. He also wanted to see. There's the little guy. Where
you know how that doll came into being? A friend of mine, John Hughes, had taken a book to a friend of his out in California that was doing political dolls for like $500 a doll.
Yeah, we're talking, these were the dolls that were used in like the Phil Collins video or...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so he showed her the book and the paintings done by Rudolf Doss in the Netherlands. And she said, oh, I could make an image like that, a dummy. He said, well, would you make one? I want to send it to my friend. So she made the Yaga doll, just like she made the political dolls. And it came in a box one day, all scorched down my sight when I cut the tape, it popped out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty good representation of the Yaga image.
Yeah. Which has an interesting background. That was a gentleman who was a self-made millionaire, right, who ran across a craft with these Yaga.
Oh, creatures. He was sailing their family yacht, a Chuck flat-bottom yacht, in the Oostzee, the West Sea, south of Amsterdam, of Rotterdam, when he hit something in a clear channel, a bump. He thought it must be a private submarine. Somebody's out here in the channel underwater. And he saw, after the bump, he saw a body floating upside down in the water. And he jumped over to rescue the body. And he hit something solid. His knees buckled and his knees hit something solid too. But he scooped up the body and then stood up on a hard flange in a clear channel. And it was rising. And when it got awash, a conning tower rose up, another tower rose up out of the middle of it, and a door opened on the side, and a man came out and took the other being in his arms. And when he handed it to him, he noticed that the face and the visage was very much different from our own.
Mm-hmm.
It was in an environmental helmet. And it looked just like the one that came out, walked out and took him. And he followed him into the conning tower down the spiral stairs to where the alien handed the other body to somebody else down there, and then sat him down in the chair at the bottom and showed him how to operate controls to zoom the pointers, pick things out and look at them, and then went behind a screen, behind a window, where he sat down with some others where he had taken his helmet off at a table. There was about four of them at a table on the other side of the screen with windows facing the control room that the witness was sitting in. And he could ask them questions, and they would bring up scenes on the viewing screen in front of them of their home planet, their automated agriculture, for instance, and their aquatic farming, ocean farming, and their cities, where the towns were nothing but huge silos. With hundreds of apartments. I think there were like 300 apartments in each one.
It looked like pretty nice little condos.
Yeah, and all those apartments were modular apartments. They could be unplugged and pulled out and transported to another silo and put in a similar hole in the same place, and all the utilities fit. So they could move their apartments wherever they wanted to if they wanted to change the location. And a city might be a dozen or more of these what looked like huge silos, like 3,000 feet in diameter or something like that. Huge thing.
Yeah.
It's with hundreds of apartments.
One thing, I'm a vegetarian. One thing I remember from the IARGAN is that they were vegetarian too. They grew plants that were similar to meat type product.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that in the story. Really interesting. Now, this was a story of, and this guy was, I mean, well-respected businessman.
He was a billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
He made automotive parts like Delco here, but he made automotive parts for European cars.
Mm-hmm. So he didn't care whether people believed him or not.
He didn't want anybody to know about it. He thought it'd be dangerous to his business.
Oh, really?
He made us use a false name and everything else.
The
aliens called him Seth of the Earth. Seth de Naerde. So we called him Stephen de Naerde.
Oh, interesting.
That's how we got the name.
Uh-huh.
His real name, now I can tell you, he's dead now. His real name was Adrian Beers.
Adrian Beers.
Yeah.
Now, these were not human-looking creatures.
Well, they were human-like creatures.
Mm-hmm.
No, they had their visage was entirely different from ours.
Yeah.
And they could remain underwater for an hour at a time. They were amphibioid.
Hmm.
They had more water on their planet than we have. And we have like 73% water.
Quite a bit.
There was like 80% water.
Mm-hmm.
And they had water farming. They had a whale-like mammal that they captured when they were young and would implant something in their brain. They could be summoned with a tone broadcast into the water, and they'd summon them into milking stations, and the whales would swim right in, they'd milk them, and the milk was so rich it was almost all cream.
I don't remember that part. Wow. So the messages, with all of these different contactees you've worked with, do the messages that they're receiving seem similar?
No, they're all different.
Mm-hmm.
Which leads me to believe that the amount and nature of life out there is infinitely, first of all, there's a lot of it everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's infinitely varied. And I've had them explain to me that there is a law of infinity in creation that represents the grandness of the deity itself, which they call the creation, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And they say it's like there's no two leaves the same on a tree, there's no two snowflakes the same, there are no two humans the same, there are no two humanities the same, there are no two planets the same, there are no two suns the same, there are no two galaxies the same,
mm-hmm.
no two constellations the same. Everything is infinitely varied in the creation.
Mm-hmm.
And the creation is constantly creating something new.
Yeah, I mean, even to modern days, the messages, the people who purport to be contactees, even abductees who believe they've received messages, often the messages aren't the same, even though some of these people are saying, I've got the word, I've got the truth.
Yeah, and that's why they never will have the word. It's infinitely varied.
Yeah, which I think makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have to be so dogmatic about it. Which almost brings us to another case, because I know not everybody. Some people are dogmatic about Billy Meyer and his messages. And you were one of the first researchers to research the Billy Meyer, another amazing case. How did you get involved with that?
Well, I was exchanging pictures with Lou Zinstad, who was a niece of Carl Jung. And she was
Wow.
the first European UFO researcher and investigator in all the continent over there.
Wow.
And she published the first journal on UFOs in the world in German out of Basel, Switzerland, before any other journal came along.
Interesting. So is that why Jung was interested in UFOs?
Yeah, and so I was exchanging photographs with her regularly, and she called me in about 1976 and said, I got something I want to show you, but I can't trust it to the mail. I'm coming to the States to do some more research on George Adamski. And I'll come through Tucson and show them to you what I have if you're interested. I said, oh, by all means. So she arrived a month later, and she called me from the bus station. I went down and picked her up. She got to the house. Lee and Britt Elders were visiting me at the time. And she opened her purse and pulled out these six pictures that she had. She handed them to me to look at, and truly, they were better than any I had ever seen before. And I knew, and we all knew, that if they're too good, they're too good to be true. They're probably fake.
Uh-huh.
So these sit in that cover. They're just too good to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And after studying it for a month, I decided I'd got to go to Switzerland and see this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So she offered to translate my letters to him. I'd write them in English to her, and she'd rewrite them in German, and he'd answer in German. She'd rewrite them in English and send them to me. After about the third exchange in the same month, she says, this is getting to be too much of a job. I'm going to bring somebody else in. She brought in Ilse von Jacobi from Jewish, which was the UFO organization in Germany that was publishing the weekly UFO newspaper, all UFOs, the only UFO newspaper in the world.
Wow.
And both Luz Zinstag and Ilse von Jacobi wrote and published articles in five languages. So I sent the next letter to Ilse Jacoby, and she did the same thing. She sent me the bill. She kind of like to back send me the answer. And this is about the time I decided I've got to go look it in the eye. And Ilse Jacoby said, well, you'll need a translator because he doesn't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked her to go with me, and I picked her up in Frankfurt and took her to Zurich with me. And Billy had moved by that time. He wasn't at the address in Hinwil. And she didn't know what his new address was. And I had another young lady with me that they were both somewhat psychically sensitive. They both depended on their intuition. And so we don't know where he's moved to. And I got a rented car and I got the two women in there. And when they both agreed that we should make such and such a turn, we'd make it.
Really?
And we'd come to another intersection and we'd stop, and maybe when they both agreed we should go such and such direction, we would. And we ended up driving up right up in front of his house.
So they intuited their way.
They were correct.
Amazing.
We got right to his house, and when Ilse Jacoby got out and knocked on the door and asked if they knew Billy Meyer, his wife, that answered the door. And they invited us right in.
Uh-huh.
We sat down at their kitchen table, which was a door, an ordinary door with four legs on it.
Oh, really?
And served us coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy sat down across from me, and I looked at him, and I looked at my translator, Ilse Jacoby, and I said, I looked Billy in the eye, and I said, I just had to come and ask you some serious questions about those pictures. He said, you may ask me anything you like, Mr. Stevens. I've been expecting you.
Oh, wow.
And so I looked at my translator, and my mouth was open, and my eyes were big, and she said, I didn't have to speak English. I said, he just did. And then I asked him, I said, how long have you been speaking English? And his answer was, oh, Mr. Stevens, if you were a Chinaman or an Arab and sat down there across from me, I would be able to speak to you. Speak slowly, simple words. And I said, I did. He got along just fine.
Amazing.
But he was such a sincere man. He never looked away. His eyes never wavered. He looked right into your soul to answer every question.
Wow. That makes me, I have to look away.
And he had 300 pictures like the six I had seen before.
That's incredible. So, and I mean, their dinner table was a door.
A
so
door.
Not, he's not a man of means.
No, he's very poor.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't own anything. He professed to be an anti-materialist. He didn't carry any money in his pocket.
Mm.
Never did. Mm. He never offered to pay for anything. Never tried to pay for anything. If he went for something, he got the money from the women and went to get it. If one of us was along, he'd get to still get the money from the women. If we offered to pay for it, he'd let us do it. But he would never let us be exorbitant.
Mm-hmm.
Everything had to be the most economical you could get.
So when you met him, it was early on. So he must have, was he, is it in the middle of his experiences where he was still?
It had already been going on for a year and a half.
Okay. So he was probably still at that time getting photos.
He was still getting photos,
and
yeah.
Film.
I tried to follow him to rendezvous when he was going, and they never let me go in the car. When somebody drove him in the car, most of the time he went on his moped alone, but if somebody had to drive him because it was going to be too far, there was never room in the car for him. And they were never allowed to get close enough to see the craft either. And they had to let him out and then leave before the rendezvous would say the contact would take place. And one time he asked him, he says, I don't understand this secrecy. Why can't I bring somebody else into the contact? And they said, it's very simple. They said, the problem is not ours. We can entertain another visitor, 10 visitors, 100 visitors, 1,000 visitors. Nothing is a problem for us. We could entertain 5,000 if necessary. But they said the problem will be with you and who you bring in. They said no two human eyes see the same anything exactly the same because they come from different environmental backgrounds, different educations, different experiences, different everything. And so they can both look at the same identical event happening and they both see it in a slightly different way. They won't fully agree on everything that they saw. And they said if you bring a third one in, he's going to have different ideas from the first two. But they said in time, you'll find that the two will agree, and then three will agree. And by that time, you have factionalism developing. And they said, it will evolve like your own Christian church. You have 226 different Christian religions, all think they're the true one, and all the rest are pagan, because of the same thing, factionalism. They said, it's more economical for us to just break off the contract with you and find somebody that doesn't need, feel that he needs to share his experiences with anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we never tried to get into contact again. It made good sense to us.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, so you really, and it took going out there for you to feel that this case was legitimate.
I went back 11 times.
Because, mm-hmm. of course, this case is very controversial.
Oh, yeah. Every case that gets, that has any energy behind it gets very controversial.
Well, I guess all of the contact cases, every single case we've brought up regarding the contactees are very controversial.
They all have been controversial because there's always detractors that are massaged and maneuvered by the people that encourage the detractors. The government doesn't want the information to travel because they don't want it to go anywhere. They don't want it to develop. So they abet the detractors.
Yeah, well, and it seems people are very ready to accept a picture, a photograph, a movie, but when it comes to actually talking to entities, and especially if they look human, people just don't seem ready to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there seems to be, and in your experience, a lot of evidence towards that. Someone is asking, I want to ask this question, we're almost out of time, but someone keeps asking in the chat about Stephen Greer, and if I know you are familiar with this stuff, and what do you think about his information?
Well, I like his motives. He wants to force the government to give up the secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, well, he's not really ready to do it. He's trying to force their hand, and they're not going to let him force their hand.
Mm-hmm.
So he does everything he can to force the government to do something proactive instead of counteractive.
Mm-hmm.
And he put out a notice of an upcoming briefing to this President Obama, where he wants to lay out some of the key points of Obama's program when he was running for election. Free energy, new jobs, new technologies, and he's got all of that. He has free energy devices he's been pushing for years that came from extraterrestrial contacts. And some of them are very good. Some of them are very workable. But they've all been locked up by opposing forces that don't want us to keep selling electricity. They don't want us to be to furnish free electricity for anybody regulating it. It's not good for the electricity market.
Yeah.
And so they're all trying to stop him from doing it. But it's out there. There are free energy devices. There is scalar point energy and vacuum energy and all kinds of energies that we haven't tapped because every time somebody succeeds, it's bought up by the power companies or the oil companies and or the guy's killed off and his invention is stolen.
Yep.
And we've had that happen, reported it happen over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So there are many ways to skin the cat, but anybody that comes up with a new way is either going to lose his life or he's going to lose his invention.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. But not only thank you for coming on the show, but thank you for all of your amazing work. And I've talked about this in the last few weeks that we have a lot. We have your research in your file out here with Open Mind, so we're definitely looking into and posting more. We'll get to posting a lot of that information because it's great. The photo collection is absolutely amazing. But thank you for being on the show. Thank you for all of your work, and hopefully we'll have you on again then.
Okay, thank
maybe
you.
Maybe in a few weeks or something like that because there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, okay.
All right, well, we won't have a show next week because we are going to be in Las Vegas, Nevada, and not just a party. We're actually helping with the UFO Crash Conference that Ryan Wood and his father put on. So that's where we're going to be. So you can look at ufoconference.com to see more about that conference. We're also at openminds.tv. We're going to be streaming that live, so that's going to be really cool. But that's where we'll be next week. But in a couple of weeks, we'll have something new and exciting. Thanks for joining us, and you guys have a lovely weekend.